yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a-screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, this week we want to continue our critique and analysis of this thing called neoliberalism. You all have heard the term, probably. And there are a lot of books and articles written about neoliberalism so far. So why are we writing another one? I'm referring to the book that I've just published called The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Economic Policy from Reagan to Trump. By the way, you can find out more information about that. Go to my blog, jackrasmus.com, where you can, if you're interested, you can order the book at discount, 20% off. Just click on the book icon, and it'll take you to PayPal. Okay? So let's continue. Why? Why another book on neoliberalism? Well, because I felt for a long time that the analyses of most of the accounts of neoliberalism have been insufficient, particularly on the economics side. And the term itself, I felt for a long time, has some serious ideological elements in it, which obfuscate a deeper analysis of the capitalist system, which neoliberalism is about. You see, neoliberalism, for a working definition, is really about how capitalist, particularly U.S. capitalism, restructures itself in the face of a crisis to maintain U.S. capital hegemony, both globally with capitalist competitors and domestically for challengers from home on the domestic front, you see, mostly labor, but other social movements as well. That's what restructuring is all about. And most critiques of neoliberalism don't cover this restructuring, or what you call the material basis for neoliberalism, or don't do it very well. Some will look at what happened in the 1970s when there was a major crisis in the economy, U.S., U.K., and global economies at that time. The crisis was a virtual slowdown of real investment and economic growth amidst runaway inflation and other negative developments economically at the time. So neoliberalism is really the third restructuring of the capitalist economy in the 20th century. I say the third because there were prior restructurings, very similar restructurings, where U.S. capital changed the policy mix and changed its programs and policies to deal with a crisis or an opportunity. You see, neoliberalism is the third restructuring that begins in the late 1970s, actually under Carter, but really implemented under Reagan when he comes into office in 1980-81, and then continued under George Herbert Walker Bush, then expanded under Clinton, and then really expanded and deepened at the same time under George W. Bush, and then under Obama in the 2008-09 crisis and the global crash, it hit a wall. One of the themes of my book is that not only does it analyze the origins in the 70s and 80s of neoliberalism, the third restructuring, and look at the subsequent phases of neoliberalism, under the subsequent presidents. But it argues that it hit a wall with the crash of 2008-09, and Obama couldn't really put the pieces back together again. Only a few of them, and the rest were still in crisis. And this crisis of neoliberalism continued under Obama's 8 years of 6 years after the crisis of rule. So it crashed under Obama, and I explained how it did. And then it's important to realize that Trump is the attempt to reestablish neoliberalism on a new, aggressive, virulent level, which is necessary for this to be reestablished. A kind of neoliberalism 2.0, you might say. We have with Trump, new aggressive form of neoliberalism, which has not been fully restored either. On certain fronts, it has been in a new aggressive form, but on other fronts, it still has not been. And in the book, I have chapters that describe why Trump's new aggressive neoliberalism 2.0 has not yet been fully restored, and why it cannot be and will not be restored. What are the material forces that are developing behind the scene that will prevent its full restoration? And we'll talk about those. Basically, capitalist changes going on in the product markets, in the financial markets, in production processes, in the global trading system, in the financial structure and financial changes. These are fundamental changes that are going on all the time at the ground level of capitalism, of capital itself. And one of the themes in the book is that these ground-level material developments in capitalism upset the policy mix at a certain point, and the policies no longer work. And capitalism has to restructure its whole policy mix in order to bring the policies in line with the material forces behind it. Because the policies may have worked in the sense of ensuring capitalist economic growth and expansion. They may have served that expansion and that growth, but at a certain point they come in contradiction with those fundamental forces. And the policies have to be changed, have to be restructured. So there's a sense of restructuring that goes on naturally within the capitalist system by itself that cannot be stopped. But then there's a sense of induced restructuring, which is changing the policies and the programs to better come in line with those fundamental forces that are changing. Well, this has occurred several times in the 20th century. As I talk about it in the book, there was a major restructuring of the U.S. capitalist economy on the eve of World War I. After the financial crash, by the way, of 1907-08, we had a stagnant economy in the U.S. and Europe, by the way, between 1908 and 13. Stagnant in the sense of following the crash, the growth was maybe a half of what it ordinarily was, and that the economy slipped in and out of recessions. Mild recessions, right, didn't last very long, but the recoveries from the recession were not robust either. And if you look at the data for 1908 to 13 in the U.S., that's what you see. Low level recoveries followed by low modest recessions, and there were two, maybe three of them that occurred between 2008 and 2013, and there also problems in Europe, which I believe played some role in the clashes in Europe among the capitalist elites that led to World War I. Well, during that time, the U.S. Restructured its economy and the policies. How did it do that? Well, that was the period we get the income tax, the corporate income tax, the personal income tax, the inheritance tax, the modern tax structure at that time. And there was also the time when, on the monetary policy side, the Federal Reserve was created. So major fiscal monetary policy shifts. And in World War I, industrial policy shifts as well with regard to labor and wages and so forth, right? And, of course, the dollar, external policy, dollar and trade, becomes a major player on the world stage as well. So major restructuring in fiscal policy, meaning tax and spending and debt, and major restructuring in monetary policy, meaning Federal Reserve and interest rates, and industrial policy as well, towards labor and wages and benefits and so forth, and what we call external policy, which is not just trade, in other words, the exchange in goods and services, but the role of currencies and currency exchange rates changed at that time. The U.S. comes out of this first restructuring on a par with Great Britain and Europe in terms of a global capitalist player. Right? The gold standard collapses, you know, another structural change that occurs. It took several years in the 1920s for it to fully collapse, first in Britain, but then in the U.S. as well by the 1930s. So the restructuring on the policy side is four main elements: fiscal policy, tax, spending; monetary policy, central banks, interest rates; industrial policy, unions and regulations, deregulations or regulations and so forth, wages policy, privatizations and so forth, and finally external policy, which is trade and money flows. Those are the four policy elements that had a certain mix and weight between them in this first restructuring. A second major restructuring occurred at the end of World War II, with the beginning of the Bretton Woods agreements in 1944, which restructured the global external policy. We have the birth of the IMF and the World Bank and the ascendance of the dollar. You know, the dollar after the first restructuring was kind of on par with the British pound. Well, and of course, gold was involved in the gold standard at the time. But with the second restructuring in 1944 to 53, we have the dollar that becomes the ascendant global currency. And we have these new institutions globally, IMF, World Bank, and so forth. There was supposed to be something similar to the World Trade Organization to come out of Bretton Woods, but the U.S. scuttled that, believing that, well, why should we negotiate with other countries on trade issues? We are the by far the dominant trade economy. The rest of the world was on its knees, and so the U.S. Scuttled that third element that was supposed to come out of Bretton Woods. So we have a shift once again in fiscal policy that occurs in the second restructuring I just mentioned, 1944-53, a big shift in government spending policy, military spending, was baked into the system. The decision was government would be 20% of GDP, whereas after the first restructuring, it was only 3% in the 1920s. The tax system was restructured as well to have more working class taxation. It was broadened. Payroll deduction of taxes, income taxes was instituted. So major changes in the tax system and spending system, i.e. fiscal policy, occurred in the second restructuring. External policy, as I mentioned, as well, in the second restructuring. Industrial policy, the unions had achieved significant growth and influence in the 30s, especially during World War II. They were, you know, at least 35-40% of the labor force was unionized, and especially the basic industries were 100% unionized. So the industrial policy was shifted after World War II with the Taft-Hartley Act attacking the right to strike and taming union power. And that's when we also saw the birth of benefits like pensions, negotiated pension plans and health care plans, health and welfare plans. That was totally new as well. And that's a story in and of itself, why the government required businesses to provide that negotiated so the government would not have to provide it. In other words, no Medicare for all. And that was a major restructuring on the industrial side. And then monetary policy was shifted as well after World War II. So you have these four key elements, policy elements, that have existed for over a century now: industrial policy, monetary policy, external policy, and fiscal policy. And each restructuring has a particular mix and weight and character to it. It's different after right before World War I, it's different after World War II. And when we get the crisis of the 1970s, we come up with another particular mix of policies, of those four policies, quite different than post-World War II, prior World War I. And this third restructuring on the policy level is what we call neoliberalism, a particular mix of industrial policy, fiscal policy, monetary policy, and external policy. And again, remember, external policy means not just trade of goods and services, but it means money flows. It means currency exchange rates. It means the role of gold and the dollar and so forth. Right? So that's what neoliberalism is from a material basis understanding. The economy had come to a crisis in the 1970s, and the policy mix that was created post-World War II no longer ensured the continued growth and expansion of capital in the 1970s. And in fact, it can be shown, as I do in the book, that that policy mix came in contradiction to the growth of capital in the 1970s. So that policy mix had to be changed. And that, those changes in the policies in those four areas is what we call neoliberalism. So neoliberalism, in practice, is a set of policies, a particular weight and mix of a certain set of those four policies in response to a crisis of capitalism itself. And in the U.S., of course, it's to change the mix of policies to ensure U.S. capital's hegemony over its competitors globally, capitalist competitors, and to check the growing power of social movements and unions and union movement domestically. So really, you know, neoliberalism is about class. It's about imperialism abroad, and it's about checking and containing and rolling back domestic challenges. And we saw that in the 1970s. The unions in the first part of the 70s had achieved a level of power and influence unlike any time before. If you look back in the early 1970s, the unions were winning contracts, strikes, going on strike and winning contract gains of 25% increase in wages and benefits in just the first year of three-year agreements. A massive strike wave occurred in 1970-71 in the U.S., led by construction unions that were like 80% unionized, followed by the transport unions, the Teamsters, and railroad workers, followed in turn by manufacturing, auto workers, steel workers, longshore workers, massive increases, and it couldn't be stopped. The capitalists could not stop these strikes by themselves, so they brought in the government to help them, and that's where Nixon's wage freeze and all those other policies are about. And we had all the social movements demanding regulations and new programs, you know, environmentalist programs, occupational safety and health programs, pension reform, social movements for more democracy and more social spending, you know, the women's movement, the black movement, Chicanos, gays, and so forth. The whole country was on the move in the 1970s, and it was challenging and costing money to the capitalists. At the same time, Europe and Japan were challenging the U.S. Global dominance on the international front. And the Soviet Union, of course, was expanding in Africa and in different places. So it was a crisis in the 1970s, a material crisis of global capitalism, in particular U.S. and U.K. capitalism. And out of that comes a shift in the new policies, a new policy mix, a shift. Right? And that shift on the policy level we call neoliberalism, a particular combination of policies, of those four policy areas. That's what neoliberalism in practice is about. And that shift expanded neoliberalism under Reagan, thereafter evolved. It continued to expand and evolve. And I have chapters on the various phases associated generally with the presidents, right? And how that evolved, you know, over the 1990s and the early 2000s until it hit the wall in the 2008 crash and Obama couldn't put Humpty Dumpty back together again, which gives us this reaction under Trump and a new aggressive attempt to restore the neoliberalism policy mix. Very long chapter, about 100 pages on the Trump efforts to create neoliberalism 2.0, a restoration, and a new virulent level, aggressive level, both domestically and globally, of neoliberalism. And then the concluding chapters of the book argue and show why the material forces, why capitalism at the ground level is continuing to change in product markets, financial markets, labor markets, production processes, and so forth, and why that will is negating Trump's ability to restore neoliberalism. We can see it most vividly on the global front with his attempt with his trade wars, which are not succeeding, particularly with regard to China. We've been talking here about neoliberalism in practice, you know, as a historical fact, as a material changes underlying capitalism and the policy responses to those material changes and the contradictions that grow over time between a policy mix and the continued growth of an expansion of capitalism, right? The policies which at first in the 80s and 90s of neoliberalism worked and helped restore U.S. global hegemony and at home checked and destroyed most of the decimated the labor movement, right? Okay, so you have that going on. But then those same policies no longer work in that regard, no longer help capitalism expand and recover. They come in contradiction. And contradiction meaning they actually slow it down and cause instability. Slower real economic growth and more financial instability are the result of the policies that once worked and now no longer work. And I say no longer work, I mean after two or three decades, they began breaking down. And we're in the breakdown period right now of neoliberalism. And the question is, what comes after this if Trump cannot restore neoliberalism. What comes after it? Well, you know, either something more progressive replaces it, or something even more onerous than neoliberalism as we know it. This is the 2020s crisis that's coming. I can't predict which and what is actually going to happen, but we can see that something is going to happen, both in the material basis of capitalism itself, and I have chapters on that, by the way, and we'll talk about that on a future show. We can point to the fact that the current solution, late neoliberalism, is not working. What replaces it is hard to say. It could be a number of different new mixes of policies. Right? So far, we've been talking about neoliberalism in practice, you know, the policy mix and how the policies change, and the material basis underlying that. But we haven't talked about neoliberalism as an idea. In the book, I critique most of the analyses of neoliberalism because a lot of the analyses, the books and the articles focus on neoliberalism as an idea, not on neoliberalism as in practice, as policies and material changes in the economy. Now, some books mix it. In other words, they talk in part about the idea and they talk in part about the practice. You know, books by Naomi Klein and David Harvey and so forth will talk about both elements of neoliberalism, but some of them get locked into simply neoliberalism as an idea, an idea which they argue is resurrected classical liberalism. Some of the tenets of classical liberalism: free markets, markets are efficient, government should not intervene, tax cuts create jobs, deregulation and privatization boost the economy, deficits and debt, right? The role of money, etc. These are ideas of classical liberalism. Classical liberalism meaning going back to Adam Smith and some of those that followed, right? Adam Smith, 1776, Wealth of Nations, right? Well, in the book, in the first chapter, I critique the critics who emphasize neoliberalism as an idea. And I point out with references that neoliberalism is not liberal. It's not liberal at all. It has very little to do with classical liberalism of Adam Smith. And in fact, it's quite different. And I take each of these major tenets, you know, free markets, right? That liberalism and neoliberalism are for free markets, meaning no government intervention, you know, let the market do whatever it does, a good, bad, or ugly. Well, neoliberalism is not about free markets. You know, they deregulate, get rid of regulations, get rid of, and push privatization. Yeah, neoliberalism does that, but not to create free markets, but just to lower the costs of big capital. That's what this is about. That's what deregulation is about, just lower the cost. It doesn't mean that big capital that remains operates in the context of free markets. Quite the contrary. Capital does not like free markets. They like controlled markets. They like markets in which they can get rid of their competition. And big companies are always trying to drive out their competition, destroy it or absorb it, or get rid of it in one way or another. That's an inherent characteristic of big capital. Get rid of the small guys. So there's no such thing as deregulation for the purpose of creating free markets. Markets are not free. Under capitalism, under neoliberal capitalism. Not by a long shot. Efficient markets, right? That's another argument, right? Adam Smith argued, well, markets are more efficient in many cases, efficient meaning producing at a lower cost goods and providing at a lower price because the cost is low, goods that a greater amount of consumers can now obtain, right? Low cost, low price, and more people get it, right? That's what efficiency is in the classical liberal sense. Low cost of production, low price, lowest possible price without the company producing going out of business, and the most goods available to the most number of people. That's efficiency. That's production efficiency. Well, is neoliberalism efficient? Can you say that when you have so many people unemployed, that that's efficient? When you have productivity slowing and pretty much stagnant, is that efficient? When you have massive crises like 2008-09 and trillions of dollars for households and consumers lost, you know, 14 million people were foreclosed, $4 trillion in pensions were lost, $4 or $5 trillion in low interest rates, meaning retirees were not able to earn any interest. That's not efficient. That's tens of trillions of dollars of inefficiency. And then, of course, the inefficiency of pollution, you know, and the cost of that, or the inefficiency of rentier price gouging by pharmaceutical and health insurance companies, right? Or the waste in military production that no one gets to buy. That's not efficient. Well, that's neoliberalism. So this argument that, the markets are efficient, is just a cover for deregulating and lowering the cost of big businesses or privatizing what was public goods, public services, public lands, right? Privatizing it so that capital can make even more money off of it. So, you know, neoliberalism, while it says free markets, efficient markets, has nothing to do with free and efficient. What about government intervention, another element of classic liberalism, or, you know, neoliberalism as idea? Well, neoliberalism is not about eliminating government in the economy. Quite the contrary. Neoliberalism is about more intense involvement of the government in the economy, but on behalf of big capital. Reduce government involvement in the economy on behalf of households and non-capital groups and classes, right? Reduce that, cut government social spending, but subsidize big business even more and investors even more. And that, of course, we see going on with the $15 trillion in tax cuts for the rich and corporations since George W. Bush in 2001, $15 trillion, yeah, and rising and continuing, right? That's government intervention. And what about the central bank, the Federal Reserve intervention, bailing out the banks, keeping interest rates at virtually zero, enabling companies to issue trillions of dollars of bonds and paper, which it then redistributed because the rates were so virtually low, which then it then distributed in stock buybacks and dividend payouts to its big investors. Yeah, subsidization via low interest rates monetary policy, subsidization via tax policy, and the ever-growing defense war spending. That's all government intervention under neoliberalism. Now, so neoliberalism is not liberal about reducing government intervention, it's just changing the shift of what it intervenes on behalf of. What about the idea that tax cuts create jobs? Well, that's not a liberal concept at all. In fact, it's neoliberal, but if you read Adam Smith, the classic liberal, believed that if you raise taxes, it would force companies to become more efficient. In other words, it would force them to introduce more machinery and more technology and so forth to overcome the tax cost that would create jobs. Yeah, liberalism says raise taxes to create jobs, not cut taxes. What about deficits and debt? Well, liberal idea was very much for maintaining a low level of government debt, only necessary for wars and defense, and balancing the budget for to reduce deficits. Well, look at neoliberalism. Neoliberalism is about let's just keep the deficits growing and the debt growing. That's okay. Neoliberalism is about what's called the twin deficit solution. In other words, allow U.S. corporations to move offshore big time. In fact, subsidize them with tax cuts to do so. Get them to move offshore so that they produce at a less cost and greater profit. Let them send back the products that they've produced offshore to the U.S. And, of course, for that, you need free trade, right? So there's no tariffs where it's stuff coming back. Get the indigenous capitalists in these other countries to play ball, give them a nice cut of the whole deal, move production, move what they say supply chains offshore, U.S. supply chains offshore, and let them produce and send back the goods under free trade back to the United U.S. market, right? That's part of the twin deficit solution, because what it does is create a massive trade deficit, you see. We end up importing, mostly from U.S. companies abroad, by the way. 49% of the deficit with China is U.S. Multinational companies doing business in China. Yeah, well, Trump doesn't do anything about that, does he? Yeah, all you have to do is force these U.S. multinationals to move back to the U.S., which Trump says he's going to do, but he never does. And you would end the deficit, the trade deficit with China. But that's not part of neoliberalism, you see. Neoliberalism is about encouraging free trade and encouraging offshoring, and then having those goods flow back to the U.S., even though you get a massive trade deficit. In other words, more money, more dollars accumulate offshore as a result of this trade deficit. We import more than we export. But that's all planned, you see. It's not by accident. Because the twin deficit solution of neoliberalism includes the agreement by these global indigenous elites, capitalists in these other countries, to recycle the excess dollars back to the U.S. Recycle it. How? By buying U.S. treasury bonds and bills and notes, and by investing to some extent in U.S. businesses in the U.S. So recycle that deficit back to the U.S. And because the recycling involves hundreds of billions of dollars every year, the U.S. can run a budget deficit. Yeah. And in other words, it can spend more on war and defense, and it can at the same time give tax cuts to investors and corporations, which creates a deficit, a budget deficit in the U.S. But that budget deficit is offset by the flowback of dollars from the trade deficit. That's what's called the twin deficits. Well, that's part of neoliberalism, developed, by the way, in the 1990s, an expansion of neoliberalism. And that's quite different than classic liberalism saying don't run deficits and don't run up the debt. Another important element of liberalism, classic liberalism, is the role of money. Under classic liberalism, the idea was money was neutral. You could not get growth in the economy by pumping money into the economy, excess money. In other words, lowering interest rates. Growth was really the result, according to classic liberalism, of increase in capital, you know, physical capital, increase in the labor force, and the quality of both the capital and the labor force, and expansion of the exploitation of land and natural resources. It was land, labor, and capital, physical elements, growth, that determined the expansion and of the economy. It was not pumping money into the economy. Money was neutral, right? Well, that's not what neoliberalism is about. Neoliberalism is about relying on money injections into the economy as the primary way of trying to stimulate economic growth. The idea being that the more money you give to holders of capital, particularly to finance capital, that they will then trickle it down into some real investment in structures and buildings and plant and equipment and so forth. Flood the finance capitalists with as much money as you can, and you know, maybe they'll share a little bit of it. In other words, the central bank and low interest rates and quantitative easing and all that is the only way to get economic growth. Well, you get a little bit of economic growth, and you get a lot of accumulation of financial profits and growth of financial assets. You get the financialization of the U.S. and global economy, which is a hallmark of neoliberalism. But it's just the opposite of classic liberalism view on the role of money and the neutrality of money proposition of classic liberalism. So if you look at the whole idea of neoliberalism, you know, it says it adheres to these classic liberal tenets, but it's quite the opposite in almost all elements. Well, why does it do that? Well, this is the role of ideology, you see. Ideology is simply the misrepresentation of reality in order to justify the policies and actions of a particular elite. That's what ideology is. It's not an ism. Ideology is obfuscation and misrepresentation of reality. And neoliberalism plays this role. There's a ideological element in the whole concept of neoliberalism, because it claims to be liberal when it's actually quite the opposite. It's not liberal at all. It's a contradiction to liberalism when you look at it from a comparison of what classic liberalism said it was and what neoliberalism is in practice. In the book, I contrast this neoliberalism as idea and neoliberalism as practice. And of course, I debunk, as I've just said, the idea of neoliberalism, and I emphasize the material basis and the policy shifts and mix of neoliberalism. Unfortunately, a lot of accounts focus on this ideological element of neoliberalism, because they fall into believing what neoliberalism says it's about, and believing that's what it is. And they point to the evolution of ideas from the late 1940s, you know, by conservative intellectuals, you know, Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman and others, you know, these intellectuals who create this idea of neoliberalism, and they think that the ideas gave rise to the policies. No, it's just the opposite. The capitalists got together in the late 70s and created this new policy mix called neoliberalism, and they then drew upon classical liberal ideas as a justification. It's quite the opposite cause and effect relationship. Okay, so what are the main tenets, you might say, of neoliberal policy? Let's get back to neoliberalism in practice, not neoliberalism idea. Well, And this explains the particular mix of those four policy areas. And the mix is quite different in those four policy areas from the post-World War II restructuring and policy mix, and different again from the policy mix of pre-World War I. You have the four elements, you know, fiscal policy, monetary policy, industrial policy, external policy, in all three cases of restructuring. But the policy mix is different under neoliberalism. You know, the first restructuring enabled the U.S. capitalists to become co-competitors on a level with the Europeans, right? The U.S. ascended to an equality, almost, of economic power before and after World War I. After World War II, it became the hegemon, the economic and political power, right? That required a different policy mix. And then we have the crisis of the 70s, and in order to deal with the Europeans and the Japanese challengers globally, we come up with the neoliberal restructuring and policy mix. And now that is breaking down here since 2008-09. All right, so let's go back to what is the initial and neo-policy mix? What is it constituted of? Well, as I describe it and analyze it in the book, right, neoliberalism as a policy mix is about more aggressive social program policy cuts focused heavily on reducing and eliminating government programs that were introduced from 1934 to 1965. So cutting social program spending is an element of neoliberalism. Second, aggressive deregulation of industries, especially banking and finance, communications, public transport, but also education and healthcare. Deregulate these industries. Privatization of employer-contributed healthcare and retirement services introduced with the second restructuring. In other words, healthcare and pensions come out of a World War II as a you know, element in the policy mix, meaning quite unlike neoliberal, but now neoliberalism is about privatizing these and deregulating these. But we get now privatization of military services as well going on, and the police, and other public goods and services, federal lands. Deep reduction in business investor wealthy household taxes on profits and capital incomes. In other words, tax cuts on interest, dividends, rent, and so forth. Okay, so that's fiscal policy as far as spending and taxes are concerned, but a chronic escalation to war and defense spending amidst social spending austerity. You know, most accounts of neoliberalism focus on austerity, in other words, cutting social program spending. But that's only one of many elements of what neoliberal policy is about. It's not just about austerity. It's about expanding defense spending, you know, why you're being austere with social program spending. It's a tolerance of rising budget deficits and national debt and interest on that debt. It's central bank monetary policies based on chronic liquidity injections designed to ensure low-term bank interest rates that subsidize business costs of investment. That's the monetary policy element. It's an incremental deunionization and weakening of collective bargaining and ensuring the compression of most wage incomes. Not wages at the top, right? Because there's certain occupations that are needed to expand capital, but most that aren't so needed are compressed. The wages are kept in real terms from really growing. Right. Promotion by government of radical changes in labor markets, creating millions of contingent labor jobs, low-paid service jobs, atrophy of minimum wages, massive offshoring of manufacturing employment, and encouragement of onshoring of skilled labor visa policy, H-1B, L-1, visas. Okay, that's the labor market changes, industrial policy changes of neoliberalism. External now, subsidizing free trade for traditional trade policy measures based on tariffs, quotas, and administrative measures to maximize U.S. corporate profits. Acceptance of U.S. trade deficits in exchange for a twin deficit solution, ensuring U.S. offshore dollar recycling by major allies and global trading partners. Encouraging a long-term U.S. dollar exchange rate and U.S. money capital outflows and foreign direct investment. In other words, keep the dollar low. Right. And promotion of financialization of the U.S. economy at the direct expense of real asset investment that generates real economic growth. Financialization, I've argued in other publications, is not simply about a share of profits that are going to banks, right? No, financialization is about creating shadow banks. Unregulated, they are, mostly, and ensuring highly liquid financial asset markets globally and linking them technologically. Shadow banks like hedge funds, private equity funds, investment banks become dominant over commercial banks like J.P. Morgan and Wells and so forth. They are increasingly in trouble, but the shadow banks are growing and penetrating markets everywhere. So financialization is about expanding shadow banks and their total asset control their dominance, growing dominance in markets, and providing all these highly liquid financial asset markets globally, creating securities like derivatives of all kinds to buy and trade in these liquid markets, and enriching a segment of the capitalist elite, which I call the global finance capital elite, of which there's maybe 200,000 globally here, most in the U.S. and Europe, but rising in Asia. This new global finance capital elite is really becoming the dominant force here globally and politically as well. I mean, look in the U.S. Who's been running Trump policy? Goldman Sachs, people from Goldman Sachs, that an investment bank, in other words. And before that, under Clinton, it was Citigroup and so forth. But now it's Goldman Sachs. Whether it's Steve Mnuchin or Gary Cohn or Dudley at the Fed or whatever, these are all people who work for Goldman Sachs, right? And they're in the driver's seat, and they're the ones who who concocted the $4 trillion Trump tax cut behind closed doors and stuffed down the Congress, which gladly ate that shit. Financialization is the markets, the shadow banks, and the new finance capital elite. That's the way to look at it. And that's a characteristic of neoliberalism. That was really expanded, created under neoliberalism purposely. Globalization is all about the financialization of the global economy, first and foremost, right? And the twin deficits arrangement. That's what globalization is really about in terms of capitalism. Okay, so I just listed the particular policy mix, industrial, fiscal, monetary, and external, of neoliberalism when it first came into dominance here under Ronald Reagan. And then it expanded. It expanded thereafter under George W. Bush. Well, think of George Herbert Walker Bush, Daddy Bush, as a phase of neoliberalism in which it was consolidated. Reagan pushed neoliberal policies pretty far. It caused contradictions, and they had to clean it up. My chapter on George H.W. Bush is really about the consolidation and cleanup of neoliberalism. But then it expanded again under under Clinton during his term, and I explain in the chapter how that occurred, right, particularly on the trade level, which the trade solution, the trade element of neoliberal policy was undeveloped under Reagan. But thanks to Clinton, it was expanded, and Clinton's industrial policies, for example, were also very neoliberal, and monetary policy as well. And then we get George W. Bush, where the chapter is called Neoliberalism on Steroids, right? All the elements were now in place from Reagan to Clinton, and they were all deepened and expanded even further. And then it hits the fan under Obama, and Obama can't put it back together again after 6 years in office, and we get the reaction of Trump to that whole experience. What's missing in the critique of neoliberalism, even on progressive elements of neoliberalism, is this understanding of the material origins that give rise to restructuring of the economy that gave rise to neoliberalism, that particular policy mix we call neoliberalism, right? Critiques of neoliberalism fail to really look at the four policy areas, industrial, fiscal, monetary, external, and how they relate to each other, how they support each other, and how they come in contradiction to each other. There are inherent contradictions in the neoliberal policy mix that I talk about, right? There's very little understanding of how the twin deficits work, very little analysis typically on external policy, on trade, on money capital flows, on foreign direct investment. So most critiques don't understand the international economic aspects of neoliberalism. They look at free trade treaties, but that's only part of it, right? You got to look at exchange rates. You got to look at money capital flows. You got to look at financialization globally and so forth. On industrial policy, the critiques do look at the deunionization and offshoring and wage compression, right, and industry deregulation, right? But they don't really understand the rise of contingent labor, part-time temp work, and that key element in keeping wages down. Or, especially, they don't understand the emerging new forces on the industrial level of artificial intelligence and machine learning and the impacts on labor markets these things are beginning to have and will intensify significantly in the coming years. And I mean just in the next 5 years, right? And why worker versus capitalist relative power has collapsed. The unions have been destroyed, but even in the non-union areas, the relationship of power is increasingly at the benefit of management and capital, right? There's not a fuller understanding among the critiques of the contribution of contingency, AI, machine learning, what's happening with the gig economy, with the Uberization of the economy, what's happening with the Amazon effect on the economy. In other words, the analysis of the industrial policies of neoliberalism is lacking, just as the understanding on the external policies is lacking in this most of these analyses, especially on the financialization. While they talk about it, they don't really understand capital markets and the role of shadow banks and derivatives and the rise of a new global finance capital elite and how that shift of power in financialization is sucking money capital out of real investment, causing the real economy, production of goods and services, to slow, secularly, slowly, right, over time. And that, of course, means low productivity and the problems of real growth and recovery that we see. So that relative shift to financial asset investing that crowds out real investment is left largely unconsidered by the critiques, most of these critiques, right? And then the whole changing nature of imperialism, the financial side of imperialism, is misunderstood or not sufficiently understood. Most progressive critiques are still relying on 19th and early 20th century analyses of what imperialism is about. They're overly influenced by Lenin and Hilferding and others, and they haven't really brought the analysis up to the 21st century here, right? And they don't understand the material forces and the material bases for the restructuring, both natural restructuring of capitalism changing and induced restructuring from the policy mixes and changes. There's very little linking up of the policies with the material changes underlying it. And finally, they do not understand how neoliberalism is the force that is driving the decline of democracy and democratic institutions, practices, parties, electoral system, and norms in the U.S. There's very little connection. I have a chapter just on that that concludes the book. What's the connection between neoliberalism and the collapse, slow but so far inexorable, decline of democracy in America? Neoliberalism, as it incurs another crisis here that we're in the middle of neoliberalism, and as it becomes more aggressive and virulent, has to brush aside democracy. You see, democracy stands in the way of restoring neoliberalism. Trump's neoliberalism 2.0 cannot restore itself because of this problem. Of democracy standing in the way. So, neoliberalism is cannot coexist with democracy over the long run. And we'll see how that plays out next decade as well. Okay, well, that will do it for today. That's the analysis of neoliberalism. We'll have one more show on this where I want to talk about Trump, Trump's neoliberalism 2.0 in particular. Okay, that's it for today.